So while talking about how the material is not to be rejected, but it is to be selected. The most standard example of this is the whole system of Varnashram. The Prabhupada says in one lecture that Varna is for the body, the ashram is for the soul. It's a broad generalization, but still in principle, according to our bodily nature and according to our bodily inclination, the Varnas basically give us occupational duties. And the ashramas are progressions for primarily a spiritual growth. So, in Varnashram, the principle is that whatever is our nature, that is used for the purpose of our dharmic growth. And we see that at one level in the Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there is transcendence of Varnashram. There is the famous verse of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu where he says, Naham vipro nachandarpatir. Napi vaishyo nashudro. Naham varni grahapatir. Naham varni nacha grahapatir. Navanastho yatirva. Hintu prodhyam nikhila paramananda. Krishna purnamrdabde gopi bhartur padakamalayor dasa dasa anudasa. So he says, I am not a Brahmana Kshatriya Vaishudra. I am not a Brahmachari Grahastha Anapasu Sanyasi. I am simply the servant of the Lord of the Gopis. So this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu especially sings this when he is beholding Jagannath. When Jagannath is just coming out, the Jagannath Yatra time. So in principle, this is our ultimate aspiration. But in conduct, if we see, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did act quite strictly as a sannyasi. He was very strict about following the rules of sannyasi. And similarly, about following the rules of a brahmana. So when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu lived in Varanasi, at that time he stayed at the house of Tapan Mishra. He stayed at the house of Chandrasekhar Acharya. And he would go and take prasad at the house of Tapan Mishra. Now we may say, this is very strange. And if a sannyasi is staying at somebody's house, why wouldn't he take the prasad at the same house? Because the expectation, because Chandrasekhar Acharya was not a brahmana. At that time, the social expectation, especially among the Mayavadis who were there in Varanasi, was that sannyasi who knows what is shuchi and what is muchi, knows what is pure and what is impure, a sannyasi should not take food that is cooked by anyone other than a brahmana. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu deferred to that expectation. And so he followed not just the rules of brahmana, but what were also the expected rules of a brahmana, even if they were not scriptural rules. Because if they felt that the sannyasi doesn't even know basic discrimination of where to take food, and how can the sannyasi speak about Vedanta to us? They would have disrespected him, they would not have been able to hear from him. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did what was required. So he followed the rules of brahmana and sannyasi also. So in an ultimate sense, we have to transcend Varanashram, but in a practical sense, we have to act according to our current situation. So Varanashram essentially means that whatever is our material disposition, what is our material position, we act accordingly. Now how does Varanashram apply in today's life? The essence of Varanashram is not so much of dividing people into categories. The point is to engage people according to their natures. So, everybody has to face problems in life. So if there is a Brahmana, and this Brahmana is told, there is a verse in the Bhagavatam which says that in emergency situations for a higher good, one can even speak a lie. Can you find this verse? A Brahmana look forward to it. Yes. Okay, I look forward to it. This verse is here, this verse is here, this verse is here. And after that, the Brahmana will give research and give all the references. If somebody is of Vaishya nature, tell them, can you find this verse? Say, there are thousands of verses in the Bhagavatam. Where will I search for one verse? Anyway, just give the class without quoting the verse. Who's going to notice?
So, for the Brahmana, it is a relishable thing. Researching scripture. For a Vaishya, it's a burden.
On the other hand, say somebody is of Brahminical nature and somebody is of Vaishya nature and they are told, we want to build a new temple and we need to raise $1 million for that. Yeah, now I've got something to do. Immediately their brain will start thinking, I'll go here, we'll contact this person, we'll make this scheme, we'll make this plan. They'll feel I've got something to do. And then if we go and tell a Brahmana, we have to build a temple and we have to raise $1 million for that. The Brahmana will say, after building a $1 million temple, we are going to discuss Shastra only over there. So discuss Shastra now. Why do you have to do all that?
So it's not that the Brahmana is right or the Vaishya is right. It is that for different people, different things may be right. So the expertise of Varnashram is that people are allocated the problems that they will like to face. So Brahmanas like intellectual challenges. Vaishyas may like financial challenges. And accordingly, when people are given challenges to face, then they feel stimulated, they feel satisfied, they feel as if I am doing something in life. So the essence of Varnashram is that whatever is our material nature, we do it, but do it in a way that is spiritually harmonious. But when we are doing our things according to our material nature, there is a danger, of course, that we just do it according to our material nature and forget the spiritual side. So I just become an intellectual and I can become an atheistic intellectual. Or I can become a materialistic intellectual. I can become a businessman. I can just become a materially motivated, greedy businessman and have nothing spiritual about it. That danger is there. So when we act according to our material nature, making the material nature as our entire nature, that danger is there. But there is other extreme also. When I reject my material nature, I simply try to act according to my spiritual nature. That is, I am a soul, I am going to serve Krishna, I will do whatever Krishna tells me to. That is very good in attitude. But in terms of execution, we may not be able to do it sustainably. So Varnashram, in its practical application in today's world will be that rather than thinking about how to divide society, who is going to divide, who is going to accept that division, all that is very complicated. The essential principle is we harmonize the material in the service of the spiritual. That whatever I am materially, how it can be harmonized so that it can help me grow in my spiritual life. That is the essence of Varnashram. And its practical application may vary in drastic ways in different situations. So Varnashram is a big subject. I will not go into that over here. My point is simply this, that the Vedic wisdom was not about rejecting the material. It was about not whatever nature you have rejected. No, it is about selecting the material. This is your nature. Use it in Krishna's service. Then, now all this, I talked primarily about the mind and how we have to act according to its nature. But along with that, I said the mind is a generator of desires. And some desires are meant to be engaged. So, say I'm an intellectual, I like to study. I'm a businessman, I like to earn money, deal in money. So those are desires which can be dovetailed in Krishna's service and they should be dovetailed. But there are also many desires the mind comes up which are to be rejected. So I started by talking about focus more on selection rather than on rejection when we deal with the mind. But that doesn't mean that rejection doesn't have to play a role. Rejection also is required. Many times the mind will come out with certain desires which can be deadly for us and we have to say no to them. Now when we talk about saying no to desires, there is something which is important, that intention alone is not an adequate protection from temptation. Sometimes when people do something wrong and they say, I never intended to do that. Well, you never intended to do that. But if we see, let's consider this from the positive perspective. You know, if somebody says, somebody doesn't prepare for a class at all, and then they come and they just, the class is not a taste of Krishna, the class is a test of everyone's patience.
Person is just rambling and not speaking anything at all.
And then they say that, you know, I intended to speak well. Well, intention is good, but you have to prepare, isn't it? Just as when we are thinking of doing something good, intention is important, but it is simply the beginning point. Intention is not everything. Intention is important, but when we are doing something good, we know the intention has to be followed with proper planning, execution, then the result will come. So same way, for doing something good, just as intention alone is not enough, similarly, for not doing something which is bad, for that also, intention alone is not enough. Say, I don't want to do this. But we all have our vulnerabilities. We all have certain temptations to which we are vulnerable. And then, just by saying, oh, I never intended to do this, that is not adequate protection. We may have to do something more practically. What does that mean in terms of... So, once we understand, okay, this is dharma, and I have certain desires which are adharmic, which I have to give up. So then, just saying that I don't want to do this, that will not... alone will not work.
So the example for this is in the Ramayana, where Sugriva, when he became a king, you know, he was a prince, but then because of the misunderstanding between Vali and Sugriva, he was banished. And he lived in great austerity in the forest. And then by Ram's arrangement, he was made into the king again. But then he had promised Ram that I will help you in finding Sita. But because the 4 months of winter were there, of rainy season were there, so they said, we cannot search now, we'll search afterwards. So according to some Ramayana commentators, actually Vali was the son of Indra. And at that time, because Vali had been killed, so Indra became very angry. And Indra showered unprecedented rains at that time. The rains were so torrential that they just reduced to helplessness. Now, otherwise, some people ask, you know, how can, you know, his wife has been kidnapped. How can you just wait? Because there are rains, so I can't search. It's not like that. The rains were terrible at that time. So they just couldn't do anything at that time. So when those 4 months, Sugriva had full intention that I will, as soon as the rains clear, I will arrange for finding Sita. But what happened? After being deprived for so long, when he got royal comfort and royal luxuries, he just lost himself, forgot. He lost himself in revelry, forgot about all his promise. And then he had to be reminded by someone else. Hanuman reminded him. Tara also reminded him. Lakshmana came and chastised him. Then he came restored to his right situation. So he had the intention, but if he's put in a circumstance where there is so much temptation, then he forgot that. So if there is temptation, just saying my intention is right, that may not necessarily always protect us from the temptation. So what do we need to do then apart from that? Here, why sometimes our intention is not enough? To understand that, we have to understand what is conditioning. And when we say we are conditioned to do something, there are various ways of understanding the word conditioning. But one way is, when we are conditioned to doing something means, we do it even before we understand that I am doing it. We do it almost subconsciously. So it just gets done from us unthinkingly. So for example, say somebody has decided, you know, okay, I'm putting on too much weight. I'm going to diet now. And then they decide I'm going to diet, but they're at their workplace, talking on phone, working on computer. And they have below some snacks. Maybe they have some fatty snack, some oily snack. And they decide I'm not going to eat it. And they also kept some healthy snack, maybe some fruit, some vegetables, some salad. Now if they're conscious, when they feel hungry, then they will go and take the healthy snack. But if they're not conscious, you know, they're talking with someone on phone and there's some tense phone call going on and they don't realize it, the hand goes and eats it. Hey, I never intended, what happened? So what happens? The conditioning means we do something even before we realize what I'm doing. That is the meaning of conditioning. So Krishna, Arjuna also expresses this when he says, Athakena prayuktoyam papam charati purusha anichan api varshneya baladivaniyojita. In 3.36, Arjuna asks, by what am I impelled to do things which I don't want to do? Anichana bivarshneya. I don't want to do it. It is as if something, baladivaniyojita, something is forcing me to do it. So how does it work out? So when Krishna talks about how kama, selfish desire, that is what makes us do these things. But the point is that when we have certain conditionings, then we do those things without even realizing what we are doing. So it is like sometimes in our computer, we may have a default program. Say if we have made, say, a particular browser as our default browser. Now, if I click on a link, I may not consciously choose to open that browser. But because that browser is made as a default browser, so as soon as the link is clicked, immediately that browser gets opened. Suppose I find out that a particular browser, it consumes too much power. So I don't want to use it. But if that is the default browser, although my intention is not to use it, as soon as I click the link, it will get opened. Why? Because that is the default setting. So just as there can be default settings in a machine, similarly, the mind is also like a machine. And our conditionings are like the default settings of our mind. So when there is a link, from that link, different browsers can be used to open that link. But when there's a default browser set, then automatically that browser will only open whenever we click a link. Similarly, say if we are conditioned to eating a particular food item. Then, whenever we feel hunger, we can conceivably eat different foods. Now, I can eat a fatty snack or I can eat a healthy snack. But our conditioning basically means that we have certain conceptions of what food is enjoyable. That is our default setting. So as soon as the hunger pang attacks me, at that time, it's like a link is clicked. And by the default setting, automatically, I'll go towards that particular fatty food and I'll eat it. So purification essentially means that our default settings get changed. So that takes time. That changing our default settings takes time. And if I'm not so tech savvy and I don't know how to change the default setting, but I know this browser takes a lot of energy, a lot of battery, then what I may do, as soon as I click a link, that browser opens up. And I'll actually consciously go and close that browser. And then maybe open another browser and put the link over there. It requires labor, it requires effort. So Krishna, while describing the qualities of a Brahmana in 18.41, he says two characters, Shama and Tama. Shama is actually peace of the mind, my peacefulness, or control of the mind, we could say. And Dhamma is control of the senses. So he says, ideally, we should just keep our mind peaceful. Don't let it get agitated only. That's the characteristic of a Brahmana. But still, there are situations in which we'll get tempted and agitation will happen. So at that time, even when the agitation happens, the Brahmana is one who does Dhamma. The mind is agitated, but at least I'll not act at the level of the senses. So best is control the mind so that there's no agitation only. But even if there is agitation, let there not be any action at the sensory level. So Shama and Dhamma. So ideally, we just reset the browser so that that undesirable browser, that power-sucking browser doesn't open only. And ideally, we reset that browser. But if the wrong browser is opening up, then what do we do? Okay, I have to shut it down. Okay, that wrong desire has, unhealthy desire has come up within me, I'll not act on it. So, conditioning means the desire comes up and we act on it even before we realize it. And for this, so that's why I said, my intention may be to do one thing, but I find out I'm doing something else. Why is that happening? Because hunger, going back to the example of food, hunger is something which is natural for me. So, I have to click a link. But that connection between the link and the browser, that is something which is set and I have not yet changed it. So if I'm conscious, I'll change it. I'm hungry, I feel like eating this, but no, I can eat this. But if I'm not conscious enough, then subconsciously, what will happen is, I'll eat something which is unhealthy. There's a survey done about, which involved asking people about how many food-related decisions they make every day. Okay, should I eat this item or that item? Should I? So like that. So on an average, this is done by, I think, Stanford University. They asked, so they said, on an average, people said we do around 15 to 20 decisions daily. Should I eat this or should I do that? Eat that. And then they went back over the full day and analyzed. They found that people make around 200 to 220 food-related decisions every day. What does that mean, 200 to 220? Every time we are just going along the road, we see some advertisement. Should I eat this? Should I not eat this? Or if I eat this, how much should I eat this? If I have a plate, there are four items. Which item should I take a second serving? Which item I should take a third serving? So, all these are decisions. But they are all decisions which are made for us. We don't even realize that we are making those decisions. So, if sometimes we are making those decisions which are unhealthy for us, the conditioning is making us do it and we don't even realize it. So, when we have to reject certain desires, first of all, we have to have the intention. Okay, I'm not going to do this. But intention alone is not enough. So, for example, if somebody wants to not eat that fatty diet, that fatty snack, then best is not keep it anywhere close by. Because if it is close by, even before I realize it, I'll be eating it. But if it is not close by, then I will not indulge in it. So, this is taking this point further. Now, when we focus on making decisions, should I do this or should I not do this? Now, we can focus more on what is wise or what is unwise. rather than what is right and what is wrong. Once we get into the zone of right and wrong, we all are very expert at proving that what I did was right. It was with the right intention. So, simple example of this could be, suppose somebody is a recovering alcoholic. And that recovering alcoholic also has a business. And he has a business meeting in a bar. You say, actually, I went there for business. My intention was good. And there's, you know, you could say there's nothing wrong in going to a bar for a business meeting. But for a recovering alcoholic over there, it's putting oneself in terrible danger. So you may say that there's nothing wrong in going to a bar. It's right. I'm not going there for drinking. But is it wise? Because I have a particular conditioning because of which I am vulnerable. So once we get into the zone of right or wrong, then people can become very strong in defending. No, this is right. This is not. There's nothing wrong in it. But the point is not whether there's nothing wrong in it. The point is there may be unnecessary danger in it. So is it wise to do it? So if I find that I have a tendency to spend a lot of time surfing on the net, then I may decide, do I need to have unrestricted net access all the time? Not having that access may restrict me a little bit. And there's nothing wrong. Many people may be able to have unrestricted net access and they will not get into any trouble. But if I have a tendency to waste time, then I may decide that, okay, I'll not always have unrestricted access. I can have restricted access at sometime I have access, sometime I don't have access. So we all may have to take decisions based on our vulnerabilities. Okay, so that we create some protection for ourselves. So rather than right and wrong, we focus on what is wise. What is wise for me based on my situation? And what is unwise for me? So if I'm doing a particular service and that service involves doing particular... Some services are very provoking. Sometimes we have to work with some people who provoke us very much and we get agitated by them. And then sometimes we may have to work in that service. There's no alternative. But sometimes we may have a choice. So I have to find out what my vulnerabilities are and I have to try to minimize the danger for myself. So that way, it will become easier for us to act on our intentions. We always need some external support by which we can transform our intention into execution. One more point in this. There is a psychological term called propinquity. Propinquity in bhakti. Propinquity, it is... Technically, it means the effect of distance and time on human behavior. Now, that seems very abstract, the effect of distance and time, but it's a very simple principle. And it has quite a lot of application. So, for example, say if this is my office, this is my home. And in between, there is a hotel. And that hotel has my favorite snack. And in that hotel, if I pass by, that snack is very fatty, it's very expensive, I don't want to eat it, I resolve not to eat it. I pass by that area. When I pass by that area, if I find, oh, that hotel is empty, I can go there and within 2 minutes, I'll be munching on my favorite snack. Then even before I realize it, I'll be driving my car inside, I'll be going out, taking out my credit card, and I'll be eating it. Hey, why'd I eat it? But if I'm going along the same road and I see there's a big crowd over there, so it'll take me half an hour in the queue to stand, by way after which I'll get to the counter, and then probably they'll take 15-20 minutes to give the serving also. So it'll take 45 minutes. Mine will say, later. I'll do it later. So what happens when there is certain difficulty in doing something? Then that difficulty itself creates a deterrence in doing that activity. So now this is not always, if I'm infatuated by the desire to take it, I will want to speak of 45 minutes. I may spend 6 hours waiting to get it. Sometimes people travel from one end of a country to another end of a country just to get a favorite snack or favorite food. So if the desire has caught me, I may go to any extremes to do it. But sometimes the desire just comes as a casual desire. And when the casual desire comes, a stray desire comes in, and if the opportunity is readily available, I will immediately indulge in it. If the opportunity is not there, I'll say, okay, later. So the mind tends to be lazy. Anything that requires effort, the mind says later. So we can use the mind's laziness in our battle against temptation. How? By making the tempting objects not easily available for ourselves. So if something is not available easily, and I have to go here, purchase this, get that, and after that I'll get it. Okay, forget it. I'll take it afterwards. Just like there is alcoholism, there is also another form of addiction which is called a shopaholism. Shopaholism means people are compulsive shoppers. Keep shopping. Shop till you drop. So many times people have like a whole, maybe their home becomes like a warehouse. So many things they have purchased and they kept it. So now, often they may not need it, but when they go to the shop, okay, maybe I can take this also. So when something is very easily available, then we are tempted to take it. But at same people, so for example, people who become shopaholics, now they are told, if you are going to go for shopping, take limited money with you. Don't purchase with credit cards, or purchase only cash, or if you're taking credit card, take a small credit card. So what happens if I have to purchase something which you're not planned to? Maybe it's important, but maybe it is not. Who knows? So if we cannot act on it immediately, what happens is, okay, I have to go back again. I have to get another money. I have to get a bigger credit card and come back. And then the mind starts thinking, should I do this? Should I not do this? Again, going all the way. Maybe I'll purchase it next time. And then next time, by that time, that casual desire has gone away. So this is not a surefire solution to all desire, But for stray desires, you know, for deep-rooted attachments, I'll talk about it in our last session about the heart. But we all have stray desires which we indulge in. The desire just comes in and we act on it. So one way to deal with the stray desires is to not make the indulgence very easily available. To create some obstacle between us and the indulgence. And that way, we'll be able to more easily resist it. And thus, we can move onwards. So what may be a particular temptation to which I am vulnerable, that may vary from person to person. And I find out, okay, this is a particular area where I find out that I just get too much into this. So then I may decide I'll restrict this myself. And there's nothing wrong in someone else doing it. But for me, this is not advisable. So that way we can make our battle against temptation less demanding for us, less bruising for ourselves. Bill Gates is the founder of Microsoft. Yeah, last year I was giving a lecture in Microsoft in Seattle. And there, one of the Microsoft employees told me that Bill Gates, for the first 10 years of his, or for some phase of 10 years, every day he would come in the same dress. Same dress he would wear. And they asked him, why are you in the same dress? He said, that is one less decision to make. So that my intelligence, my brain power is available for making other decisions. So, you know, we can say, okay, this temptation is there, I can resist it. But why face the battle? If I don't want to do it anyway, just keep it away. And then I can move onwards and do more productive things. So the focus of this talk was on selecting desires. But selection also involves a process of rejection. It's like when a candidate is selected for a job, and that means other candidates are just rejected. So like that, when we are selecting desires, we are selecting a particular desire to act on, we are also rejecting other desires. So we can make the process of rejection easier by creating obstacles in the execution of that desire. And the focus always has to be on the positive side. Okay, this is what I want to do. But while this is what I want to do, if this is distracting me, that is distracting me, then I cut off my access to those things or decrease the access to those things. Make those things less easy to achieve, and then whatever is more important for me, I'll be able to do it more effectively. So I'll summarize. We talked now about a varnashram. The essential principle is not just dividing people into varnas. It is, the essential principle is actually harmonizing people's material propensity so that it can help them in their spiritual growth. So everybody has to face problems. Give people the problems which they like to face, which they are good at facing. And that way, the selection of the positive works out. And then I talked about rejection of the negative. For rejecting something, just the intention, I will not do it, it is not enough. Despite our, just like, I will do this, that intention alone is not enough. After that, there's a plan and there has to be execution. So like that, if I decide I don't want to do something, then it will be advisable if I can make that activity more difficult for myself to do. So conditioning means it's like a default setting. Even without thinking of doing it, we end up doing it. And so we think that we are doing 15 decisions about food, but we may be doing 200 decisions. And all the other 185 decisions, they are done subconsciously without our thinking about it also. So these decisions which we do without thinking, we may have to rethink them. And to be able to rethink them and to do them rightly, we can create some obstacle between ourselves and that particular tempting object. So rather than focusing on this is right, there is nothing wrong with it. Well, there may be nothing wrong in it, but it may be unwise for me. So if I am vulnerable, then let me protect myself. Let me not increase the danger for me in a particular situation. And then I talked about propinquity, that you know, the mind is lazy. So it is, normally we talk about how the mind is lazy and doesn't want to practice bhakti. And that is unfavorable. And I'll talk about that, overcoming that in our last session. But the laziness of the mind can also be used to resist temptation. That if some temptation, we make it difficult to achieve for ourselves, then if some just stray desire comes in our mind, just like a desire to eat a snack comes in, but it's not available immediately. If a desire to purchase something comes in the mind, but the money is not there immediately, then the chances of our succumbing to that desire become lesser. And in this way, when we make it easier for ourselves to reject the negative, then selecting the positive becomes much easier. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So we have some time for questions. Okay, there were 2-3 questions which I was asked earlier also. I'll come to them. Yes, Mataji.
Yeah, you didn't finish the story of that paranoid woman who was told about
death. Oh, okay. The story about the paranoid woman, I don't think it is a story as such. But I explained that to her and she was satisfied. So I don't even know her. She just asked one question on the website. And then I answered the question and she said that yes, I'll focus on more devotional aspects of the philosophy rather than on that aspect. Okay. So, yes. So the other, yes, I'll come to you. There's one or two questions I was asked in the break. I'll answer them. It will come there. The one question about if we are to make decisions in our life, then should we make the decision based on simply what is favorable for our bhakti, or should we also consider our material nature, material situation? And sometimes we make a decision which is favorable for our bhakti, but then we find that it is not favorable for our material situation or our material nature. Then do we need to rethink that decision? Did I paraphrase the question right? Okay, yeah. So yeah, we'll come to you. So yeah, I'll start with a little graphic example and then I will come to more subtler examples. As somebody says, say like in many cities, if we have temples, temples are in the heart of the city. And there the real estate is very expensive. And some devotees may actually want to have a house close to the temple. But especially in metropolitan cities, it may require taking a huge amount of loan to get a house close to the temple itself. And I may say, you know, actually, I want a house close to the temple so that I can go to the temple. But then a person takes a huge loan, and after taking a huge loan, there's a huge installment that they have to pay. And because of that, they have to work so much, they are close to the temple, but they never get to go to the temple. They may say, you know, I purchased the house with good intention. Hell, yes, intention is good, but Krishna has also given you intelligence. You know, use your intelligence. If we don't have the capacity to have a house very close to temple, our intention is good. I want to stay close to temple. But we have to use our intelligence to check whether that intention will translate into action. So you may say, okay, monetary considerations are mundane. But you know, if I have a loan, I have to repay it. I cannot just dismiss as mundane. Those who have taken the loan, they are not going to accept that. They are going to extract it from me. So being realistic about the changes that we make in our life, even when they are favorable for bhakti, it is important also to be realistic. So Srila Prabhupada Of course, whatever Srila Prabhupada did ultimately is transcendental. It is orchestrated by the Lord. But when Srila Prabhupada got the instruction from... But we can also learn at a practical level from Srila Prabhupada. So when he got an instruction from his spiritual master that, no, you preach Krishna consciousness. You are young, educated. You preach all over the world. Now what was Prabhupada's reaction? Prabhupada, he felt that if I had not been married, I would have done it immediately. But now if I do it, it will be unfair for my wife. So it will be unfair for my wife. So he did that responsibility. Of course, that is all Krishna's plan so that Prabhupada at the age of 70, when nobody would be able to do such a thing, Prabhupada did miraculous things. So ultimately it's transcendental. But at a practical level also we can learn that Prabhupada did not neglect the practical things. So in the Leelamrita also it is said that when Prabhupada is in Allahabad, one of the persons who is interviewed, so he says, Swamiji was a very religious man. But at that time, Swamiji was asking only one question. He was not calling Swamiji Abhay Babu at that time. He was not a Swamiji. Abhay Babu is asking only one question. How can I earn more money? How can I earn more money? He was in the Grahastha Ashram at that time. That's what was required. So, if you look at Prabhupada's life, Prabhupada did a lot of things. He had a company. He was working in Calcutta. Then he came to Mumbai. Then he went to Allahabad. Very resourceful in trying out various things. So, the material factor also needs to be considered. Now, practically speaking, we need a balance. If we consider only the material factor, then what will happen is the material will never be fully favorable for our bhakti. If I wait for everything material to work out nicely, then I'll start practicing bhakti. That's like somebody who is waiting on the coast of an ocean for the waves to stop. Then I will swim.
The waves will never stop.
So if I so saying that everything material has to work out well, then I'll practice bhakti. That is not where we have to start practicing bhakti wherever we are right now. But at the same time, deciding everything only on spiritual considerations and not considering the material, that is also something which we can't sustain in the long run. We may do it for some time, but we need to practice bhakti in a way that is sustainable. And for sustainable practice of bhakti, we also have to consider our material side. Now, if you see 6.17 in the Gita, yukta ahara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta svapnava bodhasya yogo bhavati dukkha. So Krishna is saying that one who is regulated in eating, sleeping, recreation and work, for such a person, the practice of yoga will lead to freedom from misery. So, and the previous verse is even more categorical. It says, Natya ashnatastu yogosti na chaikanta manashnata na chati supna shilasya jagruto nevacha arjuna. That one who eats too much or eats too little, one who sleeps too much or sleeps too little, such a person cannot practice yoga. And one very significant thing here is, Krishna is talking about this for a person who has already renounced the world. This is 6.16, 17, 18. And in 6.10, 11, Krishna has talked about Shucha Udeshe Patishthapya Sthiramasana Matmana Natyuchitam Natinicham Chailajan Kushottam. One who is goes out of the home in a jungle, sits on a kusha grass. So even for one who has renounced the world, Krishna is saying you have to balance your body needs. Only then yoga practice will lead to perfection. Otherwise, you cannot actually be a yogi. We may be able to practice yoga for a few days, but we won't be able to practice sustainably. So balancing the material and the spiritual, both are required. So we can't reject the material for the spiritual. At the same time, we shouldn't reject the spiritual for the material also. We give due consideration to both and then make a decision. Does it answer your question? Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Yes, Mataji. Yes.
There's a few things that I wanted to ask about. The first is what you're talking about with intention, how one person may have a genuine intention but then still do something that they don't want to do. I just get the impression that a genuine intention, like if someone has the example you gave of like eating like oily snacks or something, that if someone has a genuine intention, then they're not going to eat. It's no matter what conditioning or whatever, if that isn't someone's actions a reflection of their genuine intentions. Like if someone said, I'm going to blow up your car if you stop at that hotel. Every time you stop at that hotel, I'm going to, take $200 out of your bank account. Their intention may change immediately. They wouldn't say, oh my gosh, I was just absent-minded and then I just popped it in my mouth. So it just seems like the actions are a genuine reflection. Same with like worshiping Krishna. Like someone could say like, I genuinely want to worship Krishna, and maybe they keep offering him like food that has onions and garlic or meat or something. And it's like, if I'm genuine and I have a genuine intention, I'll make the effort to give Krishna food that he tells me he likes, fruits and vegetables and rice. And then
let's take one question and come back to this. Okay. So aren't our intentions reflected in our actions? If I really genuine about doing something, then won't I do that? And if I decide genuinely I won't do something, I won't do it? Yes, that's true. And if I have a strong intention to not do something, I will give it up. But a part of that intention is also the intelligence to be able to act on that intention. So I'm not saying that intention is unimportant. But I'm saying that intention itself will express itself externally also in reorganizing things by which I'll be able to execute that intention.
Yeah.
So yes, the intention, if you consider the principle of Manas Puja, that is the idea that if somebody has an intense desire, intention to serve Krishna, even if they're not able to execute the service, Krishna accepts it. In the Bhakti Samrasindhu, it is talked about it. So we have the example of Nanda Maharaj, Vasudev. He's in the jail, in the prison, and at that time, when Krishna was born, he gave lots of cows in charity in the mud, because he had no facility to do it at that time. And later when he was released, Kamsa was killed, he came in power, he gave it actually also. So the point here is, there is intention, there is the circumstance, and then there is the action. So sometimes, the circumstance may prevent us from doing the action. At that time, the intention itself is appreciated. But my point was that when there is intention, we will also try to reorganize the circumstance. And if you are not reorganizing the circumstance, when it is in the power to do so, then that means that our intention is not genuine. We are not actually working on it adequately. So Prabhupada also says that Manas Puja is good, but if you can actually do the activity, if you can actually give charity and you say, I'm giving charity in the mind, then that is not really genuine intention. So,
that's the point I wanted to bring up, because if somebody is saying like, oh, well, I had a genuine intention, but if their actions don't reflect it, then it's
not. I would say that rather than, it's possible that somebody is using that I had a genuine intention as a subterfuge for not doing it, but it's also possible that somebody may be well-intentioned, but they may not be intelligent enough or equipped enough to do it. So what I'm saying is that, okay, you have an intention, but also you need something more to be able to translate that intention into action. Reordering our circumstances or changing our circumstances in some way so that the intention can become an action. So for example, if say this floor is inclined like this, downwards. Now you pour water on it, I may want the water to go that way. But if the floor is inclined this way, the water will automatically go this way. I may say, no, I wanted the water to go that way. No, but if the floor is inclined this way, it will not go that way. Isn't it? So, now the word inclination can refer to physical inclination of floor. We also talk about mental inclinations. So, if we have an inclination towards something, automatically our thoughts will go in that direction. So, that's why, just as if I want the water to flow that way, then I may have to change the flooring level so that the floor gets tilted that way. So, intention, if it is genuine, we will make the necessary change in circumstance so that the intention transforms into action. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so if a person does have a genuine intention and they also really don't have the intellectual capacity, then
somebody, they may have to take guidance from someone else.
Then they go from that. Okay.
Yes.
And then, in regards to this Propinquity Bhakti, it seems like this is like using willpower just in a better way, like just like tricking myself into getting really tired, so even my desires are just going to get too tired. So I was just wanted to bring up like the spiritual aspect and like tips and tricks, like make it harder that like you don't bring your credit card or you only bring cash or something.
Okay,
it's kind of like just like willpower, just like but better a little bit.
Yeah, agreed.
The spiritual aspect.
Yeah, so when we say that use propinquity in bhakti, isn't it just like we are using our willpower or using some tricks and tips? What about the spiritual aspect of, or the devotional aspect of serving Krishna? Yes, that is also important. And in fact, when I talk about the last session, I will talk about, you know, how the devotional aspect, directing our heart towards Krishna is important. But this adjusting the circumstances, it also has its value. Now, Krishna, when he talks about sense control, 2.54-72, talks about the it's a section which talks about sense control. And the first thing he says is, Yada samharete chayam kurmo angani sarvasha indriyan indriyarthebhyas tasya pragyam pratishthita. He says, just as a tortoise withdraws its limbs, like that withdraw your senses. He does say afterward, that alone is not enough to fix the mind on Krishna. But this is also important. Again, in the third chapter also, when Krishna talks about controlling kama, controlling selfish desire, he says, tasmatam indriyanyadav niyamya bharatashyava. He says, begin with controlling the senses. Controlling the mind, purifying oneself. That will come later. So, this is not sufficient. By no means, just using these tricks are sufficient. But in some situations, they may be necessary starting points. And in many situations, they may be helpful to help us to do what is vital. So, the vital thing is to redirect our heart towards Krishna. But there can be some things which may assist us in doing that. So this is, so when Krishna is talking about Yada Samharite Chayam, or he's talking about Tasmatam Indriyanyadav, he's not talking about bhakti. He's talking about general principles of sense control. He talks about bhakti later primarily in the 7th through 12th chapters. So these principles are also there in scripture, and we can apply them to the extent they're favorable for our bhakti. But if you think this is all is required, then that is not true. Yes, bhakti is definitely required for ultimately controlling the senses and for moving to closer towards Krishna. Thank you. Yes,
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Prabhu, you mentioned you have 15 books. Could you give us a brief introduction about the books, Prabhuji?
Okay, here we go. Okay, just we'll come to that just a minute. There were two questions which had been asked. No, there are. Yes, Prabhu? Okay. Please come to me.
Oh, best of learned men, the sword of knowledge is a blessing. You being expert can direct the masses. So my question is how can we become humble enough to recognize that we need to rearrange our habits?
We need
to understand that our habits need to be changed in a positive way. You know, how do we get to that standpoint where we might be doing something, but we're not humble enough to recognize that it's something that we got to change. You know what I mean? Like,
okay.
Sometimes.
Yeah. So, how can we be humble enough to learn that we have to change our habits? Otherwise, we just go along with our life. One major way is by associating with others, especially associating with devotees who are doing a lot in Krishna's service. You know, maybe we feel, okay, I have this talent, I am doing so much. But then we associate with others, we find that they are doing so much more. And nobody in the world has more than 24 hours. The wealthiest person, the most powerful person, everybody has only 24 hours. So, if I may become complacent if I'm just looking at myself. Hey, I'm doing so much. But then look at others and say, you know, okay, these devotees are doing so much for Krishna's service. Why even devotees? Because sometimes we can look at materialistic people also. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that by seeing how hard the materialistic people are working for their sense gratification, I feel inspired that I should work harder for serving Krishna. Sometimes some materialistic people, you know, they have 2-3 jobs and they are managing so many different portfolios. And it makes the mind real. How did you do this? How can you do this? You know, I have written some 15-16 books. So I may become proud, but I look at this. I just want to search on Google, and there are something like 75,000 authors who have written more than 100 books. More than 100 books. How much labor it is required for doing that? So if I look at that,
I could be doing so much more. I should be doing so much more for Krishna's service. So that means I think in Bhagavatam, 9th canto or somewhere, there's an anecdote of, I forget, there's a king, I think Mandhata is involved. He feels very proud of his opulence. But then he sees another king who has so much more opulence. And then he thinks, actually, I am not that great. He's actually dharmically proud, thinking, I have done so much dharma, by which I have got so much artha. But then he says, he has got so much more artha. He's so much more dharmic. So basically, by looking at others who are doing much more than what we are doing, we can get the inspiration to reform ourselves. That is from the positive perspective. From the negative perspective, we can also see that some of our undesirable habits, they can lead to terrible consequences. They may not have led to it right now, but they may lead to in future. So one small indiscretion, it can sometimes cause catastrophe. Somebody from the material world point of view, somebody may just drink a little bit more and then they drive a car. I think nothing happens as long as the police don't catch me and give me a DUI. But sometimes they drink a lot and they run over someone, they kill someone. And then they regret, like, what did I do? So our unhealthy habits, they can actually lead to disastrous consequences also. So we have to find out from both perspectives that becoming more self-controlled, becoming more positive, having more positive habits can help me to do so much more for Krishna's service. And tolerating or indulging in some undesirable habits, that can create me a lot of trouble. So from both perspectives, we can inspire ourselves to serve Krishna. And ultimately, our goal is that, okay, it is Krishna is not so much concerned about what I am doing. Krishna is primarily concerned about who I am. So in my heart, if I'm still having conditionings, then how much am I pleasing Krishna? I want to offer my heart to Krishna. And if there are unhealthy conditionings in my heart, then I'm not making a pleasing offering to Krishna. So from both the analytical, positive and negative analysis, contemplation, as well as the devotional contemplation, we can inspire ourselves to change. Does it answer your question? So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki. So just quickly discuss a few things. So Kadam Kanapur asked me that, okay, there are some books. Srila Prabhupada told his followers to write as much as possible. In fact, he told write every day, whatever little you can. So there is this Spiritual Scientist series. These are articles which are on current issues, which were written in Indian newspapers, Times of India and other papers. There are two books in this series. All are 52 articles, just 2-2 pages. They are good if you want to quickly read for yourself, also give to new people. This is a book especially for devotees. It's full question answers, My Little Bhakti Companion. This is question answers about managing the mind. If I find chanting boring, how can I get more taste in chanting? The practical questions about bhakti. This is a compilation of reflections on the Bhagavad Gita. This and these two books are 121 reflections on the Bhagavad Gita. Again, one page article. It can be easily read. And in different verses analyzed in different ways. This is idol worship or ideal worship. This is especially a conversation. This is especially for people who feel that, you know, you people are idolaters. You worship stone idols. So what is the philosophy behind deity worship? That is analyzed in this. This is especially suitable for corporate audience if you have any friends. This is 10 leadership sutras from the Bhagavad Gita. It is how the Bhagavad Gita principles can be applied in the corporate world, today's leadership context. This is timeless wisdom on current issues. This is about spiritual perspectives on current affairs. This is mostly back to God articles on from the Vedic Observer column and some other articles which talk about this, which are there in this book. And then this is frequently unanswered questions. So there are 52 questions over here. Again, 2-2 page answers, which talk about common questions about, is there any proof for the soul's existence, for reincarnation, and various common questions. Here there is science and spirituality. It talks about the relationship between those. There are 4 subjects. Has science discovered God? Can spirituality be scientific? Can science be spiritual? So there's a whole series of essays on the topic, science and spirituality. This is Gita for Daily Enrichment, which is 365 meditations of the Gita. We can read one every day. We can give to people also who want to read something like that on a daily basis. these two books were probably they're more suited for Indian audiences. There are two movies in India which were a lot of criticism of religion. So one was OMG, Oh My God. So this is re-answering the questions, whatever question the movie raised. There's a movie for called PK, which is very critical of religion. So I wrote a book called GK for PK. So GK is three levels. It is general knowledge, God knowledge, and Gita knowledge. And then, yeah, there are these two small books. Yeah, this is why do we need a temple? What are the practical contributions that a temple makes to the individual and society? And this is more about self-help and Bhagavad Gita philosophy. How the Bhagavad Gita can help us to become more positive in our thinking and living. Your Sutra for Positive Thinking. And we also have three wisdom pods. I have done the recording of the full Bhagavad Gita, Bhakti Shastri course in 162 classes on all the four books. So in one wisdom pod, we have chapters 1 to 12. That's around maybe 80-90 classes. Another 80-90 classes, another wisdom pod. And there's one more wisdom pen drive which has 2,000 question answers. So just like we had question answers here, we have question answers. So if any of you want that, you can please take that. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Just want to let everybody know we're going to be starting back exactly at 1:30. For people who have ordered prasadam, it is outside.